case will be argued remotely by video. It's number 21-1648, Arsys LLC against Unified Patents LLC. Mr. Bright, please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Pat Bright. I'm a lawyer from Los Angeles. I want to thank the court for permitting me to appear by Zoom today. I appreciate the courtesy. I hope the panel can hear me okay, and that my opponents can also hear me okay. Is that so?
Yes, we hear you. Proceed.
Good, thank you. Well, on behalf of appellant Arsys, I just have a couple of things I wanted to call attention to. The first is the standard of review. I think the standard is de novo. The facts on this appeal are not in dispute. My client filed a lawsuit for patent infringement in San Francisco District Court against Tesla, a fairly well-known car company. One of the patents involved in that lawsuit is also involved in the IPR at the bottom of this matter. In the lawsuit, Arsys asserted claims 21 and 22 against Tesla. Not long thereafter, Unified filed an IPR. The court may know that Tesla is a dues-paying member of Unified, and therefore we have inferred that, at least Arsys has inferred, that Unified is a stalking horse or front man for Tesla.
Well, Mr. Bright, can you hear me? This is Judge Proust.
Yes.
Good morning. Let me just move to the issue because time is limited. There's a regulation that's at issue here, 37.42.73b. And that regulation, as I read it, explicitly directs the board to construe a disclaimer of all claims as a request for an adverse judgment, correct?
Yes, but it doesn't apply here.
Okay, well.
We filed a disclaimer. And the effect of the disclaimer is that the claims at issue are treated as if they never existed, ever.
Well, isn't the regulation, doesn't that direct the board to construe a disclaimer as a request for an adverse judgment? So let me ask two questions. How would it not apply here? I don't understand anything in these pleadings to suggest that you're challenging whether the regulation was properly promulgated or was authorized by statute. So I guess you could tell me why what the regulation says is not applicable here. You filed a disclaimer. The regulation says that they can construe a disclaimer as a request for an adverse judgment, which is what they did here. What's the problem with that under the regulation?
Because here, the problem is the regulation doesn't apply because we made the disclaimer before the PTAB ever entered the judgment. The PTAB entered a judgment on claims that did not exist and had to be treated as if they had never existed. So if they never existed, how could anyone have any board, any court have jurisdiction over them?
Well, the regulation, this is Judge Proust again, the regulation says a party may request judgment against itself at any time during a proceeding. Actions could construed to be a request. So I think the regulation is referring to requests that come during the proceeding. Right?
The regulation assumes that there are claims that are still before the tribunal. But in this case, there were no claims before the tribunal. None. When the PTAB entered its judgment. The claims had to be treated by the board and everyone else in this United States of America as if they had never existed at all.
So you're telling me
at any time. Even at the beginning of the IPR, the result of the effect of the disclaimer that we made of all claims at issue in the IPR was to deprive every tribunal that might have had jurisdiction of that jurisdiction. That's why Sanofi, among other things, says when the claims are taken out of play, there's no jurisdiction. But you never even reach that here because the disclaimer before the board entered its finding of invalidity. The claims were gone. They made a finding on claims that no longer existed and had to be treated as if they never existed.
So you're telling us that, as applied here, it violates Article 3. Is that right?
That I can't understand what you just said.
You're telling us that as applied here, to apply the disclaimer at the time at which it was applied, that is, before there was a decision, violates Article 3 of the Constitution. Is that correct?
I think I heard what you said, and it sounded correct, but I must confess the sound is imperfect. And at my advanced age, my hearing isn't what it was when I was, say, 45.
Well, I'll repeat it and scream, because I'm a better screamer. Is it your argument that what was done here is a violation of Article 3 of the Constitution?
It's a little less majestic than that. It's simply this. The effect of the terminal disclaimer was to render nugatory, non-existent, all claims in the IPR. And as a consequence, neither the PTAB nor the court in San Francisco nor anybody else could render any judgment about these claims. None. It was too late. It's just as if you were bringing suit against someone and that someone died, was dead. That ended. Those claims were dead as a doornail, and they were dead even before the IPR began by reason of the disclaimer. So if they weren't in existence when the IPR began, the PTAB panel, had no jurisdiction to do anything about those claims. Nothing.
How do we get around
trying to help their good friends at Unified?
How do we get around Arthrex? We're bound by Arthrex as a panel. How do we get around what Arthrex says about this?
Arthrex doesn't address the effect of the terminal disclaimer. There are three opinions there, one by Judge Dyke, one by Judge O'Malley, and one by Judge Newman. And none of them talks about the effect of the terminal disclaimer. Or if they do, I can't discern it in what they wrote.
Can you hear me?
And by the way, Sanofi doesn't talk about Arthur T.
Can you hear better? Are we closer to the microphone? Is this clearer than before?
I can hear you fine, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. But you say that Sanofi has nothing to do with Article 3. It isn't that fresh in my mind, but my understanding, my recollection, is that it was an issue of whether there was an ongoing controversy at that stage in order to enable the appeal.
If you mean in Arthrex, there is some discussion of it.
In Sanofi.
Well, in Sanofi, the patent, the disclaimer took place when the patented issue was before an Article 3 court.
Yes.
So, and my opponents argue that the reasoning, therefore, has no application in this proceeding before the Patent, Trademark, and Appeal Board, because that's not an Article 3 court. That's their argument, as I understand it. It makes no sense to me, by the way, because any appeal from the PTAB must go to the Federal Circuit, where we are today. So why wouldn't that precedent apply here? It makes perfectly good sense to me that it should. And all of my life, I've thought, if the court has no jurisdiction over something, game over. But the terminal disclaimer trumps the whole thing, because it removes the claims from consideration, from existence, back to the beginning of time, before the beginning of all the way back to the 1952 statute.
What is the practical consequence of the distinction between the two actions? This is Judge Prost.
Between what?
Between what was done here and what you're advocating, the non-entry of an adverse judgment.
Well, the IPR system says that if the board enters a judgment, that judgment can taint any later claims applied for that may be similar to those declared invalid by the board. So The reason, one of the reasons for this appeal is to remove that taint, if that's the question you're posing. But my answer is, I think we needn't go any farther than to say that the effect of a terminal disclaimer is to remove claims back to the beginning of time and back before the IPR ever asserted jurisdiction over. That's just the way it works. It has nothing to do with me or Unified or anybody else. It's just the effect of that disclaimer. That's why ARCIS disclaimed all the claims that were before the IPR, not just the claims asserted in district court, but all of the claims that had been attacked by the IPR or in the IPR. In other words, to remove all claims that had ever been presented in the IPR for consideration. And the disclaimer destroys them for all time. Treats them as if they never existed. So I can't see how, under those circumstances, the fan dancing over whether we're in an Article III court and Sanofi applies or not makes any sense, frankly.
Okay, let's hear from the other side, and we'll pursue this further. Mr. Foreman, are you here?
Yes, I am. May it please the court, I think this case comes down to two separate but related arguments. The first is this argument about the reliance, appellant's reliance on Sanofi. But, I mean, as you read that opinion, it's all about Article III case or controversy. And I don't think there's any dispute that Article III case or controversy requirement does not apply to proceedings before the board.
Can I ask you, this is Judge Prost. Good morning.
Sure.
Can I ask you what I asked your friend on the other side, which is, what is the practical consequence for you or your client as to which way this goes in terms of disclaimer versus an adverse judgment?
So the adverse judgment triggers the application of estoppel that's also in, I think it's 42.73D. So if an adverse judgment is rendered, then the patent owner cannot obtain patently indistinct claims down the road. If there's no adverse judgment, then that estoppel does not apply. Going back to the Article 3 point, it's clear, as this court has said multiple times, that the Article 3 case of controversy requirement does not apply.
Can I just ask, I don't see much need to discuss the self-evident proposition that Sanofi is about Article 3 and that Article 3 doesn't apply to the PTAB. Why should we not construe the argument made to us as an argument that the regulation is contrary to the statute, to 253?
Well, I think that this court has addressed and rejected that same argument in Gwynn versus Koff, which is a case about interference practice. And
first of all, do you view the brief submitted to us as including that argument, and also view the submissions to the PTAB as including that argument? It's not that easy for me to find it there, let alone a developed form of it.
I don't see it in the arguments to the PTAB. I think it's made, and I think it's not made in this case by arguing that when a disclaimer is made, the claims are treated like they never existed, and that's the requirement under the disclaimer statute, section 253, and to the extent that entering an adverse judgment is contrary to that, I think it can be construed as a challenge to the regulation.
Okay, so why then is the argument wrong?
Well, I think that, as I was saying, this court's decision in Gwynn versus Koff was an interference case applying an almost identical regulation about adverse judgments, saying that if a patent owner disclaims all of the claims, claims of the interference, that will be treated as a request for adverse judgment. And this court heard pretty much the same arguments. In that decision, the argument that the patent owner made was that as a result of the disclaimer, no claim which corresponded to the single economy interference remained, so that no controversy existed between the parties. And this court addressed the argument about whether the entry of the adverse judgment was contrary to the disclaimer statute, section 253, and found it wasn't. So the court concluded the entry of a judgment against Wing in the interference is proper and consistent with his right to disclaim under section 253. So, I think that I don't see any way to distinguish that case from the current situation, even though that was an interference and this is an IPR. Both of them are adversarial proceedings before the office.
What about the, I guess it's the board decision in the CBM context when, was that pre-institution or post-institution?
The Facebook decision, that was pre-institution. That decision held that if prior to the institution decision, a patent owner disclaimed claims, then the board would not consider those disclaimed claims in determining whether the patent was a CBM patent and deciding whether it is.
So how do you square the logic of that with the opposite conclusion here?
Well, the big difference here is that in this case, the IPR had been instituted. And I think definitely from this court's Arcrex decision, you can see there are a lot of thorny questions about how to handle disclaimers pre-institution. But we don't have to reach any of them here because this is a post-institution case.
Well, the language of the regulation is during a proceeding. I know that's come up in other contexts and other cases. During a proceeding, do you know if our cases say during a proceeding includes or excludes pre-institution?
Also, in the Arthrex decision, which I believe is the only decision addressing this issue, it was a pre-institution disclaimer, and this court held that that was appropriate with one judge concurring and one judge dissenting, and those opinions made it clear that there would be some question, if the right arguments were presented in a case, there would be some question about whether pre-institution disclaimer, whether the board had the authority to enter adverse judgment in a pre-institution disclaimer case. And I think it's a much tougher question because of the language of the regulation, but it's not something that we briefed and it's not something we need to address here. This happened after institution.
So why would the question of consistency with the statute be a tougher question?
Well, I think consistency with the regulation. I think
No. I asked the question because you said look at the language of the regulation. I thought the argument that is being discussed here is whether the regulation is consistent with the statute. Why would that question, consistency with the statute, change according to whether the disclaimer was before or after institution?
I apologize. I was answering Judge Gross' question about the differences between the Arthrex case and this case. I think that this isn't inconsistent with the statute because a couple of reasons. First, I think appellant is incorrect to say that the board entered an invalidity judgment. The board did not. This was a trial proceeding that was instituted, and the board issued an adverse judgment, meaning basically found that the petitioner won and the patent owner lost. There was nothing said about the validity or invalidity of the claims. So just because the claims were disclaimed doesn't mean the board can't enter that judgment to end the proceeding. I mean, the proceeding has to end in some way, and the patent office has made the determination that if a proceeding is instituted and a patent owner decides to give up by disclaiming, then the consequence of that is the adverse judgment. I think that's a perfectly fair and reasonable way to handle it. Yeah, I mean, I have that. Oh, sorry. The other issue was that, you know, I agree that this court has held that the claims are treated like they never existed, and that it extinguishes the patent owner's rights. But this court has held that a disclaimer doesn't distinguish the rights of the public. And so here the board enters the adverse judgment for the benefit of the public so that the patent owner can't obtain, you know, patently indistinguishable claims down the road and then go try to enforce them against other parties who may not know about what's going on here. So, you know, the point of it is to protect the public interest so that another patent is not obtained and asserted against anyone else. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but.
All right. Now you've left some time for your colleague, Mr. Seastrunk.
Yes, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd first like to note that while Arsys' standard or arguments fail under any standard of review, as discussed here today, we do not necessarily agree that that their briefing, as it's written, alleges that the rule is either inconsistent with the disclaimer statute, nor do they allege that the rule was not properly promulgated. Instead, we feel like Arsys simply disagrees with the board's interpretation of the rule and the orders it issued. For example, on page 12 of its reply brief, Arsys uses phrases like properly construed and that the regulation should be read in a certain way for the PTAB to retain jurisdiction. So, like in all of its briefing, Arsys uses general principles of subject matter jurisdiction to try to support its interpretation of the rule. The point here being that even when Arsys is talking about the rule, it's talking about it in the context of interpreting the rule and the problems it has with the board's interpretation of the rule. So I think that a simpler solution here is that because this court has held that it will accept the board's interpretations of its own regulations unless it is plainly erroneous or inconsistent, and will set aside actions only that are arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion, that is the standard that should be applied here. And so we believe that deference to the PTO is appropriate where the board was interpreting one of its own regulations and where the board followed the plain language of the regulation in issuing the orders. And again, regardless, even under a less deferential standard, WNBCOP dictates that the result would be the same and that the board had the authority and the responsibility to issue the adverse judgment here. Your Honors, unless there are any questions, I will just conclude and ask for affirmance of the board's orders. Thank you.
Okay, no question. All right, in that case, Mr. Bright will have the last word. I think you're muted.
Sorry, I'm muted. I hope everyone can hear me now. Thank you for your patience with me. I'm not exactly technologically hip. A couple things. First of all, in my view, and I've tried to express it as forcefully as I can, the board's finding of invalidity, or whatever its finding is called here today, is like firing a bullet into a dead body. There can be no charge of murder because that individual is already dead. So even if that shooting is done with malice aforethought, it doesn't matter. There's no crime. Similarly here, with the disclaimer having removed these claims from existence from the beginning of time, it doesn't matter whether the board followed Rule X or Rule Y or Rule Z. The rules don't apply because the board had no jurisdiction, which is why we made the disclaimer. This is not some accident. It was done on purpose for this reason. Now, Mr. Seastrunk piously professes to be worried about the public, but we have disclaimed everything that was presented in the IPR. So the public is covered in spades. Those claims are gone forever. So the public interest has been served if we need to be worried about that.
There was colloquy before about what the concrete difference is between an adverse judgment and a mere dismissal, and I gather it comes down to the applicability of the regulatory subsection D, which does protect the public against relevantly similar claims. So there is something at stake, isn't there?
If you think that regulation means anything, but the devil's always in the details. I don't know of any case that's ever turned on that application of that rule, and I submit to the panel that its application would be difficult even if the panel, the PTAB, had the right to enter this judgment, but it did not for the reasons I've stated. And I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I think if you look at Sanofi, which comes after Arthrex, Sanofi says covers jurisdiction just the way we've all learned it from the time we got out of law school. Once the case is, you know, the subject matter is gone, the court's power to rule on it is gone. And this PTAB panel had no right to do what they did because they had no power, no jurisdiction to do what they did. And the reason is the claims were gone for all time.
And so the claims are gone. What are we fighting about?
We're fighting about the application of this rule that His Honor just mentioned before. It's something that ends with the letter D. The one that says you can't have a claim thereafter that would be patently indistinct from what has been ruled upon by the board. We don't need it here. The claims are gone. We don't need to worry about the public. The public's fine. And think of the circumstances under which you might even have a chance of getting another claim. You'd have to have a continuation, because otherwise these claims would be barred by 102B or something. So it's all that concern about the public, which we hear about so much these days, particularly from our liberal friends on the left, is just so much pious pap. Of course, the claims are gone. Let's not worry about whether somebody might apply for a claim that is similar. The patent office knows how to deal with that kind of thing, and they've been doing it forever under the 52 statute. We don't need to worry about that. Anyway, that's all I have to say. I thank the panel for permitting us to appear via Zoom. Normally, I would come in person, and I have appeared in person many a time in the court, and I would have done this time, but for the problems that COVID situation presents. And hopefully it will soon be gone, or that I will soon be gone, and either way, I won't have to travel.
Okay, thank you. So thanks to all counsel. This worked quite well, and the case is taken under submission.
Thank you.